Orpheus bowed.
Lord Hades, I am Orpheus. I'm not here as a tourist. I don't want to disrupt your realm, but my wife Eurydice recently died before her time. I cannot go on without her. I have come to plead for her life.
Hades sighed. He removed his bib and laid it across his plate.
Such extraordinary music, yet such a predictable request. Young man, if I returned souls every time someone prayed for it to happen, my halls would be empty. I would be out of a job. All mortals die. That is non-negotiable.
I understand, Orpheus said. You will possess all our souls eventually. I'm fine with that, but not so soon. I lost my soulmate after less than a month. I've tried to bear the pain, but I simply cannot. Love is a power even greater than death. I must take my wife back to the mortal world. Either that, or kill me, so my soul can stay here with her.
Hades frowned.
Well, killing you I could arrange.
Husband!
Persephone set her hand on Hades' arm.
This is so sweet, so romantic. Doesn't it remind you of everything you went through to win my love? You didn't exactly play by the rules either.
Hades' face reddened. His wife had a point. Hades had abducted Persephone and caused a global famine in his standoff with her mother Demeter. Hades could be very sweet and romantic when he wanted to.
Yes, my dear, he said, but...
Please, Persephone said, at least give Orpheus a chance to prove his love.
Hades couldn't resist when she looked at him with those big, beautiful eyes.
Very well, my little pomegranate.
He faced Orpheus.
I will allow you to return to the mortal world with your wife.
For the first time in days, Orpheus felt like playing a cheerful tune.
Thank you, my lord.
But there is one important condition, Hades said. You claim that your love is more powerful than death. Now you must prove it. I will allow your wife's spirit to follow you back from the underworld, but you must have faith that she is traveling in your footsteps. The strength of your love must be sufficient to guide her out. Do not turn to look at her until you have reached the surface. If you so much as glance back before she is fully bathed in the light of the mortal world, you will lose her again, and this time, forever.
Orpheus's throat became parched. He scanned the throne room, hoping to see some sign of his wife's spirit, but he saw only the faces of withered zombie guards.
I understand, he said.
Then go, Hades ordered. And no music on the way back, please. You're keeping us from doing our jobs down here.
Orpheus left the palace and retraced his steps through the fields of Asphodel. Without his music to focus on, he realized how terrifying the underworld was. Ghosts whispered and chattered around him. They brushed their cold, spectral hands against his arms and face, pleading for an encore. His fingers trembled. His legs felt wobbly. He couldn't tell if Eurydice was behind him. What if she got lost in the crowd? What if Hades was playing some sort of cruel joke? Coming into the underworld, Orpheus had been consumed with grief. Now he had hope. He had something to lose. That was much scarier. At the gates of the underworld, Cerberus wagged his tail and whimpered for another rendition of Old Yeller. Orpheus kept walking. At the banks of the Styx, he thought he heard soft footsteps in the black sand behind him, but he couldn't be sure. The ferryman Charon waited in his boat.
I don't usually take passengers the other way, he said, leaning on his oar. But the boss said okay.
Is my wife behind me?
Orpheus asked.
Is she there?
Charon smiled cagily.
Telling would be cheating. All aboard!
Orpheus stood at the bow. Tension crawled across his back like an army of ants, but he kept his eyes fixed on the dark water while Charon rowed. humming daydream believer, until they reached the other side. Orpheus climbed the steep tunnel toward the mortal world. His footsteps echoed. Once, he heard a sound like a small sigh behind him, but it might have been his imagination. And that smell of honeysuckle, was that Eurydice's perfume? His heart ached to be sure. She might be right behind him, reaching out for him. The thought was both ecstasy and agony. It took all his willpower not to look. Finally, he saw the warm glow of daylight at the mouth of the tunnel above.
"Only a few more steps," he told himself. "Keep walking. Let her join me in the sunlight."
But his willpower crumbled. Hades's voice echoed in his ears. "You must have faith. The strength of your love must be sufficient." Orpheus stopped. He'd never trusted his own strength. He'd grown up with his father constantly berating him, calling him weak. If it weren't for his music, Orpheus would have been nobody. Eurydice wouldn't have fallen in love with him. Hades wouldn't have agreed to send her back. How could Orpheus be sure his love was enough? How could he have faith in anything but his music? He waited, hoping to hear another sigh behind him, hoping to catch another whiff of honeysuckle perfume.
"Eurydice?"
he called. No answer. He felt entirely alone. He imagined Hades and Persephone laughing at his foolishness and falling for their prank.
"Oh, gods," Hades would say. "He actually bought it? What an idiot! Hand me another lobster, would you?"
What if Eurydice's spirit had never been there? Or worse, what if she was behind him right now, begging for his help? She might need his guidance to return to the world. He might step into the sunlight and look back, only to see her falling away from him as the tunnel to the underworld collapsed permanently. That seemed like just the sort of trick Hades might play.
"Eurydice," he called again. "Please, say something."
He heard only the fading echo of his own voice. If there's one thing a musician can't abide, it's silence. Panic seized him. He turned. A few feet behind him, in the shadows of the tunnel, less than a stone's throw from the sunlight, his beautiful wife stood in the blue gossamer dress she'd been buried in. The rosy color was starting to return to her face. They locked eyes. They reached for each other. Orpheus took her hand, and her fingers turned to smoke. As she faded, her expression filled with regret, but no blame. Orpheus had tried to save her. He had failed, but she loved him anyway. That knowledge broke his heart all over again.
"Farewell, my love," she whispered.
Then she was gone. Orpheus's scream was the most unmusical sound he had ever made. The earth shook. The tunnel collapsed. A gust of air expelled him into the world like a piece of candy shot from a windpipe. He yelled and pounded his fists on rocks. He tried to play his lyre, but his fingers felt like lead on the strings. The way to the underworld would not open. Orpheus didn't move for 7 days. He wouldn't eat, drink, or bathe. He hoped his thirst or his own body odor might kill him, but it didn't work. He begged the gods of the underworld to take his soul. He got no answer. He climbed the highest cliff and threw himself off, but the wind just carried him gently to the ground. He searched for hungry lions. The animals refused to kill him. Snakes refused to bite him. He tried to bash his head in with a rock, but the rock turned to dust. The guy, literally, was not allowed to die. The world loved his music too much. Everybody wanted him to stay alive and keep playing. Finally, hollowed out from despair, Orpheus wandered back to his homeland of Thrace. If his story ended there, that would be tragic enough, right? Oh no, it gets worse. Orpheus never recovered from Eurydice's death. He refused to date other women. He would only play sad songs. He ignored the Dionysian mysteries, which he had helped invent. He moped around Thrace and brought everybody down. Now, when you've gone through a big tragedy, like watching your dead wife turn to smoke, most people will cut you some slack. They'll sympathize up to a point. But after a while, they'll start to get annoyed, like, enough already, Orpheus. Join the human race. I'm not saying it's the most sensitive way to act, but that's how people are, especially if those people happen to be Maenads. Over the years, Orpheus had built up a lot of goodwill with Dionysus' followers. He'd organized their festival. His dad was a veteran of the Indian War. But eventually, the Maenads got miffed that Orpheus wouldn't join their parties anymore. He was the most eligible bachelor in Thrace, but he wouldn't flirt with them. He wouldn't drink with them. He would barely even look at them. Orpheus's mom, Calliope, tried to warn him of his danger, but her son wouldn't listen. He wouldn't leave town. He just didn't care. Finally, the Maenad's anger boiled over. One night, when they'd been drinking more than usual, they heard Orpheus playing his lyre in the woods, another song about tragic love and desolation. His sweet voice drove the Maenads even crazier than they already were.
"I hate that guy," one shrieked. "He won't hang out with us anymore. He's a total wet blanket."
"Let's kill him," another yelled,
which was the Maenad's answer to most problems. They swarmed toward the sound of Orpheus's lyre. Orpheus was sitting on the banks of a river, wishing he could drown himself. He saw the Maenads coming, but he just kept playing. He didn't care about dying. He wasn't sure he could die. At first, the Maenads threw rocks at him. The stones fell to the ground. The Maenads threw spears, but the wind brushed them aside.
"Well," said one of the Maenads, "I guess we'll have to take matters into our hands."
She brandished her long, pointy fingernails.
"Ladies, attack!"
Their wild screams drowned out Orpheus's music. They swarmed him. Orpheus didn't try to run. He was actually grateful that somebody was willing to kill him and let him see Eurydice again. The Maenads obliged. They tore him to pieces. Afterward, the silence was oppressive. Even the Maenads were horrified by what they'd done. They ran, leaving Orpheus's body parts scattered through the woods. Calliope and the other muses eventually found him. They collected what they could and buried the remains at the foot of Mount Olympus. However, two important things were missing: Orpheus's lyre and his head. Those floated down the river Hebrus and washed out to sea. Supposedly, his lyre kept playing on its own, and his decapitated head kept singing as it floated away, like one of those Furby toys that just won't shut up. Sorry, I still have nightmares about those things. At last, Apollo plucked the lyre out of the sea. He threw it into the sky, where it turned into the constellation Lyra. Orpheus's decapitated head washed up on the island of Lesbos. The locals made a shrine for it. Apollo gave it the power of prophecy, so for a while, folks from all over would come to Lesbos to consult with the severed head of Orpheus. Eventually, Apollo decided that was a little too creepy. He silenced the oracle. The shrine was abandoned, and Orpheus's head was buried. As for Orpheus's spirit, I've heard rumors that he was reunited with Eurydice in Elysium. Now he can look at his wife all he wants without fearing she'll disappear. But wherever they go, just for safety, Orpheus lets Eurydice take the lead. I guess that means they lived happily ever after, except for the fact that they both died. There's probably a song in there somewhere. La, 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 I'll love you dead or alive. La, la, la. Nah, never mind. I think I'll stick with sword fighting. Music is way too dangerous. Hercules does 12 stupid things. Where do I start with this guy? Even his name is complicated. I'm going to call him by his Roman name, Hercules, because that's how most people know him. The Greeks called him Heracles. Even that wasn't his real name. He was born either Alcides or Alcaeus, depending on which story you read, but the great hero Al just doesn't have much zing. Anyway, before What's-His-Name was born, there was a whole big soap opera going on in southern Greece. Remember Perseus, the guy who cut off Medusa's head? After he became king of Argos, he united half a dozen city-states. Tiryns, Pylos, Athens, Buttkickville, etc. into a powerful kingdom called Mycenae. That's Mycenae. Almost rhymes with Mankini. Each city had its own king, but there was also a high king who ruled over the whole nation. The high king could be from any city, but he was always supposed to be the eldest descendant of Perseus. Confused yet? Me too. By the time the third generation of Clan Perseus rolled around, the leading contenders for High King were two cousins from the city of Tiryns. One guy was Amphitryon. The other was Sthenelus. With handles like that, you'd think they were awarding the kingship to men with the most unpronounceable names. Amphitryon was older by a few days, so everybody assumed he would get the job. Then he messed up by accidentally killing his father-in-law. It happened like this. Amphitryon had been negotiating with this dude, Electryon, for permission to marry his daughter, Alcmene. As soon as they struck a deal, Electryon called in Alcmene to give her the good news. Electryon.
Alcmene, meet your new husband, Amphitryon.
Alcmene.
Okay. A heads up would have been nice.
Electryon.
Don't be so glum. He's going to be the High King soon. He paid a good price for you. Also, he loves you. You love her, right?
Amphitryon.
Uh-huh.
Alcmene.
You just met me.
Amphitryon.
Uh-huh.
Alcmene.
Can you say anything other than uh-huh?
Amphitryon.
Uh-huh.
Alcmene.
Dad? This guy is a moron.
Amphitryon.
But I love you. I love you this much.
Spreads his hands. Accidentally whacks Electryon in the face and kills him. Amphitryon.
Oops.
Alcmene.
You're a moron.
When the news got out, the other royal contender, Sthenelus, saw an opportunity to seize the high kingship. He publicly accused Amphitryon of murder. He ran a big smear campaign with posters and town criers and TV ads.
This moron murdered his father-in-law. Can you trust him to run our country?
Ultimately, the heat got so bad that Amphitryon had to flee Mycenae. He dragged along his new wife, Alcmene, who wasn't too happy about it. They settled in Thebes, a town northwest of Athens, outside the Mycenae power zone. Amphitryon became the city's most important general, but that wasn't saying much, since the Theban army was about as powerful as a squad of mall cops. Alcmene was totally not into her husband. Technically they were married, but the fool had killed her father and gotten them both exiled.
"There is no way we are having children," Alcmene told him. It would bring down the IQ of the entire Greek civilization.
I will prove myself to you, Amphitryon promised. What must I do?
Alcmene pondered that.
Go conquer a bunch of cities. Show me you're a good leader. You can start by destroying the island of Taphus. My brothers attacked that place a few years back and got slaughtered. Avenge my brothers.
Amphitryon lost track of what she was saying after the first few words.
What?
Alcmene pointed.
Taphus! Go kill!
Okay.
Amphitryon took his army and had a bunch of adventures that I won't go into. There was a fox that couldn't be caught. There was a dude with long blonde hair who couldn't be killed. There was blood and maiming and pillaging. You know, pretty much the average weekend in ancient Greece. Amphitryon killed people and destroyed things until he figured he had proven himself to be worthy of Alcmene. Then he turned his army around and marched for Thebes. He was anxious to get home and have his honeymoon. He'd been married to his wife for over a year now, and they hadn't even kissed yet. Too bad for him. Someone else also wanted a honeymoon with his wife. Our old friend Zeus, the god of the sky and cute senoritas, had been watching Alcmene. He liked what he saw. Zeus had promised Hera, for the 30th time, that he'd stop fooling around with mortal women. Of course, he had no intention of keeping his promise, but still, he figured he'd better try to stay off the radar when he visited Alcmene. He decided the simplest way would be to show up looking like her husband. Zeus transformed himself into an Amphitryon clone and flew down to Thebes.
"Honey, I'm home," he announced.
Alcmene walked into the living room.
"What are you doing here? The messenger said you were still with the army. I wasn't expecting you for another 3 days."
3 days, Zeus thought. Excellent.
"I'm home early," he announced. "Let's celebrate."
Zeus ordered pizza. He opened a bottle of champagne and put on some Justin Timberlake. At first, Alcmene was suspicious. Her husband didn't seem as moronic as he had been before. But she had to admit, she preferred this version of him. Maybe he had learned something from his adventures. They had a wonderful romantic night together. In fact, it was so wonderful, at one point Zeus excused himself, took his phone into the bathroom, and texted Helios, the sun god.
"Bro, take a few days off. I need this night to last."
Helios texted back,
"Are you with Alcmene?"
Zeus,
"Totes."
Helios,
"OMG, she's hot."
Zeus,
"IKR, question mark?"
Helios left the sun chariot in the garage for the next 72 hours. By the time dawn finally rolled around, Alcmene was suffering from sleep deprivation and a Justin Timberlake overdose. Zeus kissed her good morning.
"Well, that was great, babe. I should get going. Gotta check on army stuff."
He strolled out the front door. 10 minutes later, the real Amphitryon walked in.
"Honey, I'm home."
Alcmene gave him a blurry look.
"So soon? Did you forget something?"
Amphitryon had been hoping for a slightly more enthusiastic welcome.
No. I just got home from the war. Can we celebrate?"
"Are you kidding? You got home yesterday. We spent all last night together."
Amphitryon wasn't the sharpest crayon in the box, but he realized something was wrong. He and Alcmene visited a local priest who did some fortune-telling and determined that the first Amphitryon had actually been Zeus. Roman storytellers thought this mistaken identity situation was hilarious. They wrote entire comedies about it. You can imagine how that went. Alcmene looks at the audience like,
"That wasn't my husband. Whoops!"
And a bunch of dudes in togas roll on the floor laughing. Anyway, there wasn't much Amphitryon could do about it. He and Alcmene had their own honeymoon celebration. By the time Alcmene was in the second trimester of her pregnancy, she knew, the way moms sometimes do, that she was carrying twins. She had a feeling one baby would be Zeus's and the other would be Amphitryon's. And the Zeus baby would mean big trouble for her. Meanwhile, back in Mycenae, cousin Sthenelus was still trying to become the High King. He thought he'd be a shoo-in with Amphitryon in exile, but nobody liked Sthenelus. He was cruel and cowardly. Besides, his name was super hard to pronounce. The nobles refused to endorse him. The commoners jeered at him. Sthenelus tried to settle the matter with a public vote, but he came in third after two write-in candidates, Mickey Mouse and Fluffy the town cat. Sthenelus's only good news? His wife Nycope was about to give birth to their first child. If the baby were a boy, He would be the oldest son of the oldest descendant of Perseus, not counting Amphitryon, of course, which meant the kid had a shot at becoming High King, even if Sthenelus couldn't. Up on Mount Olympus, Queen Hera was thinking along the same lines. She'd found out about Zeus's affair with Alcmene. Instead of going into a raging snit about it, she decided to play things cold and stealthy. "Zeus probably wants Alcmene's bastard child to become High King of Mycenae," she grumbled to herself. "Well, that's not going to happen." The next night, she did everything she could to put Zeus in a good mood. She played his favorite Timberlake album. She cooked his favorite meal, ambrosia crepes with ambrosia sauce and a side of sautéed ambrosia. She massaged his shoulders and whispered in his ear, "Honey muffin?"
"Hmm?"
Zeus's eyes crossed in bliss. "Could you make a teensy divine decree for me?"
"A divine decree? About what?"
She popped an ambrosia-covered strawberry into his mouth.
"Oh, I just thought the kingdom of Mycenae should have some peace and prosperity. Wouldn't that be nice?"
Zeus swallowed the strawberry.
"What if you decreed that the very next descendant of Perseus to be born will become the High King? Wouldn't that make things simpler?"
Zeus suppressed a smile. He knew Alcmene's twins were due any minute. Sthenelus's kid wasn't going to be born for at least another week. He just didn't know that Hera knew.
"Yeah, sure, hon. No problem."
That same night, divine oracles throughout Mycenae announced the latest news from Zeus. The next born male descendant of Perseus would become the High King. And no, the public would not be allowed to vote for Fluffy the Cat instead. After dinner, Hera sped down to the earth, where her daughter Eilithyia, the goddess of childbirth, had just arrived at Alcmene's house.
"Stop!" Hera cried. "Don't let Alcmene give birth!"
Eilithyia stepped back, clutching her medical bag.
"But she's already in labor. You do remember how painful that is." "I don't care," Hera said. "She cannot give birth, at least not until after Sthenelus's son is born." "But I don't have that on my schedule until next week." "Just come with me to Tiryns, now."
Eilithyia was used to handling the drama of childbirth. The drama of Hera, not so much. Leaving Alcmene in bed, groaning and sweating and cursing, the two goddesses flew to the city of Tiryns. Once there, Eilithyia waved her magic Lamaze pillow, and Sthenelus's wife, Nycope, immediately went into labor. Boom! 5 minutes later, she was holding a baby boy in her arms. Easiest delivery in history. They named the child Eurystheus because that was the most unpronounceable name they could think of on short notice. He was, in fact, the next born male descendant of Perseus, so the little guy was crowned High King immediately, though it was hard to find a tiara small enough for his newborn head. As for Alcmene, Hera would have let her suffer in labor forever. That's just the kind of loving person she was. But Eilithyia took pity on her. Once it was clear that Hera had gotten her way on the High Kingship issue, Eilithyia granted Alcmene a safe and easy childbirth. The first twin born was Hercules, though at the time he was called Al, followed by his baby brother, Iphicles. Proud Papa Amphitryon looked at the newborns. He immediately felt attached to both of them, though Alcmene had warned him in advance that one of the kids was probably Zeus's. "Which one is mine and which one is Zeus's?" he wondered. Iphicles cried. Al/Hercules flexed his newborn muscles and smacked his brother in the face like, "Shut up!"
"I'm guessing the muscular one is Zeus's," Alcmene said.
Amphitryon sighed.
"Yeah, you're probably right."
The next day, word arrived from Tiryns. A new High King, Eurystheus, had been born just a few hours before Hercules.
Hera must be messing with me, Alcmene guessed. That's why my labor lasted so long.
In her arms, baby Hercules shouted, "Roar!" and promptly pooped his diaper. Alcmene reeled back from the smell.
Was that an editorial comment? She asked the baby. You don't like Hera?
Roar!
More poop. That worried Alcmene, and not just because she had no idea what her kid had been eating. She'd heard all the stories about Hera torturing Zeus's mortal lovers. Her difficult labor was proof that Hera was out to get her. Her new baby, Al, slash Hercules, might get her killed. In her moment of fear and weakness, Alcmene did what too many parents did back then with unwanted children. She sneaked out of the house, took the baby to the conveniently located wilderness, and left him exposed on a rock to die. Little baby Hercules was mightily annoyed. He squirmed on the rock for hours, yelling, cursing in baby language, and punching any wild animal that dared to come close. Fortunately, Zeus was looking out for the little guy. Zeus had gotten wise to Hera's little shell game with the High King babies. He muttered to himself, "Oh, you want to fight? Okay, honey muffin, it's on." He sent Athena, goddess of wisdom, down to the earth to retrieve the baby. Hercules looked up at Athena and cooed, but his stomach was growling. Athena, not being a motherly type, didn't know what to do with him.
"I need a wet nurse," she murmured. "Someone who likes babies.
She had a very twisted idea. She took the kid to Hera.
"Oh, my queen," said Athena. "I just found this poor random baby abandoned in the wilderness. Isn't that terrible? I don't know how to feed him, and he's so hungry."
Hera didn't know who the baby was. She took one look at the little guy, and her motherly instincts kicked in.
"Aw, poor thing. Give him here. I will suckle him."
Back then, they didn't do baby bottles and formula. When a baby got hungry, you breastfed him. End of story. Usually the mom did it, but if the mom wasn't around, another woman might do the job. Hera, being the goddess of moms, figured she was up to the task. She held Hercules to her bosom and let him take a few drinks from the divine milk dispenser. The baby was going at it with gusto until Athena said, "Thank you, Hera." It was the first time she'd said Hera's name in the baby's presence. Hercules bit down hard on Hera's sensitive flesh, screamed, "Roar!" and pooped all at the same time, causing Hera to scream and hurl the kid. Fortunately, Athena was a good catch. Some legends say that Hera's breast milk sprayed across the sky and created the Milky Way. I don't know. That seems like a whole lot of solar systems from just one squirt. What is for sure, those few sips of the good stuff instilled Hercules with divine strength and health, compliments of the goddess who hated him the most. Athena whisked the baby back to his mother's house. She set him down on the doorstep, rang the bell, and flew away. Alcmene opened the door. Baby Hercules grinned up at her, his face covered with milk.
Okay.
Alcmene figured this was a sign from the gods. She took the kid inside and never tried to get rid of him again. The next few months were relatively uneventful. Hercules learned to crawl. He learned to punch through brick walls. He teethed his way through several horse saddles, got put in time out for breaking his babysitter's arms, and even spoke his first word.
Mangle.
One night, when he and his brother Iphicles were asleep, Hera decided to get rid of her least favored toddler once and for all. If I allow this child to grow up, she thought, he'll be nothing but trouble. Zeus is watching over him, so I can't just blast the boy to ashes. I know. I'll arrange a believable accident. A couple of poisonous snakes in the nursery. That happens all the time, I'm sure. Two nasty vipers slithered through a crack in the wall and made straight for the children's beds. Iphicles woke first. He felt something gliding over his blanket, and he screamed. Down the hall, Alcmene heard him. She bolted out of bed and shook her husband awake.
Amphitryon, something is wrong in the nursery.
The parents rushed in, but they were too late. Hercules had taken care of business. With his super-fast toddler reflexes, he had grabbed both snakes by their necks and strangled them to death. By the time his parents arrived, Hercules was standing up in bed, grinning and waving the dead vipers.
Bye-bye.
As for Iphicles, he was huddled in the corner, under a blanket, screaming and sobbing. Amphitryon sighed.
Come on, Iphicles. I've got you. Sorry, little dude. You're stuck with my DNA.
After that night, our snake-strangling hero got a new name. He was no longer Alcides, Alcaeus, or any other flavor of Al. He became known as Heracles, Roman Hercules, which means glory from Hera. Thanks to Hera, he was famous before he even graduated preschool. Hera must have loved that. As he grew, Hercules had some really good teachers. His dad, Amphitryon, taught him to drive a chariot. The generals of Thebes taught him sword fighting, archery, and wrestling. His only weak subject was music. His parents hired the best lyre player in town, Linus, who was the half-brother of Orpheus, but Hercules had zero musical skill. His fingers were just too big and clumsy to manipulate the strings. Eventually, Linus lost his patience and screamed, "No, no, no! That's a C scale!" Linus ripped the lyre out of the boy's hands. He smacked Hercules across the face with it. FYI, being hit in the face with a lyre hurts. Hercules yanked the lyre back from his teacher. "See this scale!" He smashed Linus over the head repeatedly until the lyre was in pieces and the music teacher was dead. Hercules was 12. He was put on trial for capital murder. If that's not straight-up hardcore, I don't know what is. Fortunately, Hercules was smart. He pleaded self-defense, since Linus hit him first, and got off easy with 6 years of community service at a cattle ranch outside of town. The ranch wasn't so bad. Hercules liked working outdoors. He got lots of fresh air and never had to take music lessons. His parents also appreciated having him safely tucked away where he couldn't attract poisonous vipers into the house, commit teacher-side, or accidentally destroy the city. Hercules was released from the ranch at age 18. By then, he was the biggest, tallest, strongest, baddest Theban in the history of Thebes. He'd been away for a long time and wasn't really tuned in to what was going on. So when he got home, he was shocked to see the townsfolk weeping in the public square, gathering all their cattle like they were about to have an auction. Hercules recognized a lot of the cows he'd raised during his years of community service. Hercules found his family in the crowd.
"Dad," he called to Amphitryon. "What's up with the cows?"
His stepfather winced.
"Son, while you were away, we had a war with the Minyans. You know those folks who live in that city over yonder? King Erginus's people?"
"Yeah, so?"
"We lost, badly. To stop the Minyans from destroying our whole city, King Creon agreed to pay them a yearly tribute of 100 cows.
"What? That's crazy. I raised those cows. Their spot right there, and that's Buttercup. You can't give away Buttercup."
100 cows may not sound like a big deal, but back then, that was like 100 houses, or 100 Ferraris. Cows were big money. They were some of the most important investments you could make. Besides, Buttercup. Dude, you can't give away a cow that Hercules had bothered to name.
"We must fight," Hercules said. "This time, we will beat the evil Minyans."
His sickly brother Iphicles spoke up.
"But they took all our weapons. That was also part of the peace treaty."
"All our weapons?"
Hercules turned toward King Creon, who stood nearby with his guards.
I leave for a few years, and you surrender all our weapons and our cows? Your Majesty, come on!
The old king blushed and stared at the ground.
We have to do something, Hercules insisted.
It's too late, Iphicles said. Here they come.
The crowd parted as a dozen big minions in full armor marched through the square, kicking old men out of their way, pushing down old ladies, and stealing churros from the street vendors. King Creon did nothing to stop them. Neither did his guards. Even Hercules' dad, the great general Amphitryon, just stood and watched as the minions bullied their way toward the cattle pens. Finally, Hercules couldn't stand it anymore.
Knock it off!
The minions halted. They watched in dismay as Hercules lumbered over. A big, hairy teenager dressed in the simple leather tunic and cloak of a cattle herder.
You dare speak to us? Said the minion leader. We are your master's cowherd. Grovel and kiss my feet.
Not happening. Hercules cracked his knuckles.
Leave now, and we won't have any bloodshed. You're not taking any more of our cows.
The minions laughed.
Look here, boy, said the leader. We have swords. You don't. We're taking these 100 cows just like it says in the peace treaty. Next year, we'll be back for 100 more. What are you going to do to stop us?
Hercules punched the guy in the face, dropping him instantly. The other minions reached for their swords, but Hercules was fast. Before their blades could even clear their scabbards, all 12 minions were lying on the ground with broken noses, black eyes, and 50% fewer teeth. Hercules confiscated their weapons. Then, gross out alert! Using their leader's own sword, he cut off each minion's nose, ears, and hands. He strung the severed parts into disgusting necklaces and hung them around his prisoners' necks. Amazingly, this didn't kill them. Once they were conscious and strong enough to walk, Hercules hauled them to their feet.
Go back to King Erginus, he ordered. Tell him the only tributes he'll get from Thebes are the grisly bits hanging around your necks.
He smacked the leader's butt with the flat of his sword and sent the mutilated minions on their way. The astonished crowd of Thebans awoke from their shock. The younger ones cheered and danced around the newly liberated cows. The older citizens, who had seen too many wars, were less thrilled.
My son, said Amphitryon, King Erginus will never forgive this. He'll be back with his entire army.
Good, Hercules growled. I'll kill them all.
King Creon hobbled over. His face was sickly green.
Boy, what have you done? I took in your family from exile. I gave you a home, and you have doomed us.
Sire, don't worry about it, said Hercules. I'll take care of the minions.
How?
The king demanded.
You have, what, 12 swords now? You can't defeat the minion army with only that.
Hercules didn't remember King Creon being such a wimp, but he decided not to comment.
The Temple of Athena, Hercules said. Doesn't it have a bunch of armor and weapons hanging on the walls?
Amphitryon glanced nervously at the sky, waiting for a divine smiting.
My son, those weapons are ceremonial. They were consecrated to the goddess. The minions didn't take them because you'd have to be foolish to use them. You'd be cursed by Athena.
Nah, Athena and I go way back. Besides, she's the goddess of city defense, isn't she? She would want us to protect our town.
Hercules turned and addressed the crowd.
We don't have to live in fear of the minions. Anybody who is with me, come to the Temple of Athena and suit up. We will trample our oppressors.
The younger Thebans cheered and gathered around Hercules. Even Iphicles, who had always been weak, sickly, and scared of his own shadow, stepped forward to grab a sword. That shamed a lot of older Thebans into joining. Amphitryon put his hand on Hercules' shoulder.
My son, you are right. I had forgotten my courage until now. Let us fight for our homeland.
They raided the temple of Athena for weapons and armor. The goddess didn't strike anyone dead, so they took that as a good sign. Hercules led his makeshift force out of town until they found a natural choke point where the road wound between two steep cliffs. The Thebans built barricades and dug pits in the path. Then Hercules arrayed most of his men along the cliff tops on either side. In such a narrow passageway, the larger size of the minion army wouldn't do them much good. The next day, King Erginus personally led his army toward Thebes. As soon as they were in the pass, Hercules sprang his trap. The fighting was bloody. Hercules' stepdad, Amphitryon, was killed in action. So were many other Thebans. But the minion army was completely destroyed. Hercules didn't rest there. He marched to the city of the minions and burned it to the ground. Hercules returned home in triumph. King Creon was so grateful that he rewarded Hercules with his oldest daughter, Megara. Even the gods were impressed. They descended from Olympus and loaded Hercules down with so much swag it got embarrassing. Hermes gave him a sword. Hephaestus made him a suit of armor. Apollo presented him with a bow and quiver. Athena gave him a kingly robe and generously agreed not to kill anyone for desecrating her temple. It was a big, old Olympian love fest. Hercules and Megara got married and had two children. For a while, life was good. Hercules took his dad's old job as head general and led the Theban army on many successful campaigns. In one of those battles, his brother Iphicles fell, leaving behind a widow and an infant son named Iolaus. But hey, at least Iphicles had died bravely. Hercules brought honor and glory to his hometown. Everybody figured that once Creon passed away, Hercules would be the new king of Thebes. If the story had ended there, Hercules would have gone down in history as one of the greatest Greek heroes, but no, he was just getting warmed up. So was Hera. Up on Mount Olympus, the queen of the gods seethed because of Hercules' successes. She couldn't allow him a happy ending. She decided to make his life as terrible, tragic, and complicated as possible, so that someday Percy Jackson would have a really hard time writing about it. I hate Hera. While Hercules was growing up as a cowherd in Thebes, his cousin Eurystheus grew up as the high king of Mycenae. That may sound awesome, people bowing to you and obeying your every command from the time you're a baby, but it gave Eurystheus a short temper and a big head. Despite that, Hera thought he was the coolest thing since fresh-pressed olive oil. She blessed his kingdom with peace and prosperity. She sent him 20 drachmas every year on his birthday. Also, she made sure Eurystheus heard all the annoying news about Hercules' exploits because she wanted the high king to be good and jealous. When Eurystheus turned 18, Hera whispered in his dreams, encouraging him to knock his famous cousin down a few pegs. "Call Hercules to your palace," said the goddess. "Demand that he serve you by doing 10 great tasks, otherwise he will never respect your kingship." Eurystheus woke. "I have a great idea," he said to himself. "I will call Hercules to my palace and demand that he serve me by doing 10 great tasks, otherwise he will never respect my kingship." Eurystheus sent a messenger to Thebes, ordering Hercules to travel to the capital city of Tiryns and serve him. Hercules showed restraint. He didn't chop off the messenger's ears, nose, or hands. He just sent back a message that read, "LOL, nah." Eurystheus was not pleased. Unfortunately, Thebes was outside his jurisdiction. He couldn't do much unless he wanted to declare war, and even Eurystheus wasn't stupid enough to go to war against Hercules. That night, Hera spoke again in the High King's dreams.
"Just bide your time. Hercules will bow before you. I will make sure of it."
Over the next few weeks, every time Hercules went to a temple, the priests and priestesses gave him dire warnings.
"The gods want you to serve your cousin Eurystheus. No, seriously, you'd better get down to Tiryns or bad things are going to happen."
Hera was behind this, of course. She was the queen of nagging. She made sure Hercules got the message dozens of times a day from dozens of different sources. At first, Hercules ignored the warnings. He was much too important and powerful to serve a little worm like Eurystheus. But the warnings kept on coming. Random guys began stopping him on the street, speaking in raspy voices like they were possessed.
"Go to Tiryns. Serve the king."
Hercules' wife got nervous.
"Honey," said Megara, "it's never wise to ignore the gods. Maybe you should go to the Oracle of Delphi and, you know, get a second opinion."
Hercules didn't want to, but to make his wife happy, he went to Delphi. It was a miserable trip. The offerings cost a bundle. Delphi was crawling with merchants hawking cheap souvenirs. Finally, Hercules made it to the front of the line to see the oracle, and she told him the same thing he'd been hearing for weeks.
"Go to the city of Tiryns. Serve High King Eurystheus by doing 10 great tasks of his choosing. Thank you, and have a nice day."
Hercules got so angry that he swiped the oracle's three-legged stool and chased her around the room with it.
"Give me a better prophecy," he yelled. "I want a better prophecy."
Apollo had to intervene personally. His divine voice shook the cave.
"Dude, not cool. Give the oracle back her tripod."
Hercules took a deep breath. He didn't feel like getting killed by a golden arrow, so he put down the tripod and stormed off. When he got back to Thebes, his nerves were frayed. His patience was gone. He walked through the streets, and everybody asked him,
"Is it true? 10 tasks for the High King? Wow! That sucks."
At home, Megara asked,
"How was it, honey? Do you have to go to Tiryns?"
Hercules snapped. He flew into a murderous rage and killed everyone in the house, starting with his wife. I know, this book is full of crazy, horrible stuff, but that right there, that's messed up. Some stories say that Hera inflicted him with madness, so he didn't know what he was doing. Maybe, but I think that's letting Hercules off too easy. We already know he had an anger management problem. He killed his music teacher with a harp. He chopped pieces off those minion envoys. Hera didn't have to drive him crazy. She just had to push him closer to the edge. Whatever the case, Hercules struck down Megara. He killed the servants who tried to stop him. His two sons screamed and ran, but Hercules took out his bow and shot them, convinced in his twisted mind that they were some kind of enemy. The only one who escaped was his nephew Iolaus, who'd been living with Hercules since Iphicles died. Iolaus hid behind a couch. When Hercules found him and knocked another arrow in his bow, the boy screamed, "Uncle, stop!" Hercules froze. Maybe Iolaus reminded him of his brother Iphicles, back in the old days when they were kids. Hercules had always protected Iphicles from bullies. When Iphicles died, Hercules had sworn to protect Iolaus like his own son. His rage evaporated. He stared in horror at the bodies of his children. He looked at the bow in his hands, the bow Apollo had given him, a weapon from the god of prophecies. The message could not have been clearer.
"We told you something bad would happen if you didn't listen.
In utter despair, Hercules fled the city of Thebes. His heart shattered. He returned to Delphi and threw himself on the floor in front of the oracle.
"Please,"
he begged, his whole body shaking with sobs.
"What must I do to atone for my sins? Is there any way I can be forgiven?"
The oracle spoke.
"Go to the High King as you were told. Serve him well by doing whatever 10 tasks he commands. Eurystheus alone may decide when each task is done to his satisfaction. Once all 10 are complete, then and only then will you be forgiven."
Hercules dressed himself in beggar's rags. He covered himself with ashes, then traveled to Tiryns and knelt before the High King's throne.
"Sire, I have sinned," said Hercules. "I did not listen to you or to the gods. In my rage, I murdered my own wife and children. For penance, I am here to do whatever 10 tasks you require, no matter how difficult or dangerous or stupid those tasks may be."
Eurystheus smiled coldly.
"Cousin, that's a shame about your family, but I'm glad you finally came to your senses. 10 stupid tasks, you say? Let's get started."
Eurystheus was elated. He could assign Hercules any task, no matter how dangerous, and with luck, Hercules would die a painful death. That would eliminate the biggest threat to the throne, since Eurystheus was sure his famous cousin would eventually try to take over Mycenae. Even if Hercules didn't die, Eurystheus could get some tough items crossed off his to-do list. It was like having a genie pop out of the bottle and grant you 10 wishes, except the genie was a Theban with swole muscles, a beard, and no magic.
"First task," Eurystheus announced. "In the region of Nemea, just north of here, a massive lion has been wreaking havoc. I want you to kill it."
"Does this lion have a name?" Hercules asked.
"Since it lives in Nemea, we call it the Nemean Lion."
"Wow. Creative."
"Just kill it," Eurystheus ordered. "That is, if you can."
Creepy organ music started playing in the background, so Hercules figured there was some catch to this task, but he shouldered his bow, strapped on his sword, and marched off to Nemea. It was a lovely day for lion killing. The hills of Nemea shimmered in the sunlight. A cool breeze rustled through the woods, making patterns of gold and green across the forest floor. In the middle of a meadow, carpeted with wildflowers, a huge male lion was feasting on a cow carcass, strewing scraps of bloody meat everywhere. The lion was bigger than the largest horse. Muscles rippled under his lustrous gold coat. His claws and teeth flashed silver, more like steel than bone. Hercules couldn't help admiring the majestic predator, but he had a job to do.
"That thing killed a cow," he reminded himself. "I like cows."
He drew his bow and fired. The arrow hit the lion's neck. It should have severed the beast's jugular and killed him instantly. Instead, it shattered against the lion's fur like an icicle thrown at a brick wall. The lion turned and growled. Hercules shot until his quiver was empty. He aimed for the eyes, the mouth, the nose, the chest. Each arrow shattered on impact. The lion just stood there, snarling with mild annoyance.
"Okay, then." Hercules drew his sword. "Plan B." He charged the lion.
With enough force to cleave a redwood tree in half, Hercules brought down his blade on the beast's forehead. The blade snapped. The lion simply shook off the impact.
"Stupid lion," Hercules yelled.
That sword was a gift from Hermes.
Roar!
The Nemean lion lashed out with his claws. Hercules jumped back just quickly enough to avoid getting disemboweled. His breastplate was shredded like tissue paper.
No! Hercules shouted. That was a gift from Hephaestus.
The lion roared again. Hercules roared back. He punched the lion between the eyes. The lion staggered, shaking his head. He wasn't used to feeling pain. He wasn't used to retreating either, but he decided Hercules wasn't worth messing with. Cows were easier prey. He turned and bounded into the woods.
Oh, no, you don't.
Hercules ran after him. He followed until the lion disappeared into a cave about halfway up the hillside. Instead of plunging in, Hercules scanned his surroundings. If I were that lion, he thought, I'd pick a cave with two exits so I couldn't get trapped. He scouted around. Sure enough, a jagged black fissure led into the cave from the other side of the hill. As quietly as possible, Hercules piled up some boulders, blocking the exit.
Now you've got nowhere to run, kitty cat.
Hercules circled back to the front entrance and called, Anybody home? A snarl echoed from the darkness like, No, this is a recording. Please leave a message. Hercules marched inside, forcing the Nemean lion to retreat until his back was against the pile of boulders. Now, kids, cornering wild animals is usually a bad idea. It tends to make them a wee bit cranky and homicidal. Hercules was an expert on cranky and homicidal. He crouched in a wrestler stance.
Sorry about this, kitty, he said. You're a beautiful killing machine, but High King Putzface wants you dead.
The lion growled. Obviously, he didn't think much of High King Putzface. He pounced, but Hercules had been trained by the best wrestlers in Greece. He dodged the claws and slipped onto the lion's back, locking his legs around the beast's ribcage and putting that shaggy neck in a chokehold.
Nothing seems to get through your hide, Hercules grunted in the lion's ear. But let's see how you do when no air can get through your throat.
He squeezed with all his strength. The lion collapsed. Once Hercules was sure the lion was dead, he stood, breathing heavily, and admired the lion's beautiful fur.
That would make a spankin' awesome cloak, he said. But how can I skin it?
His eyes drifted to the lion's gleaming claws.
Huh. I wonder...
He used the lion's own claws to cut the hide. It still took hours of grisly, grueling work, but in the end, Hercules had a new fur coat and enough lion steaks to fill a freezer. You might think lion fur would be too hot for everyday use, especially in Greece, where the summers can be sweltering, but Hercules' new cloak was surprisingly light and cool. It was a lot more comfortable than bronze armor. Hercules used the lion's head as a hood and tied its arms around his neck. Hercules admired his reflection in the nearest pond.
Oh, yeah. Fashionable and invulnerable, baby.
He headed back to Tiryns to report to the High King. If all his tasks went this well, he might end up with a whole new wardrobe. Hercules strolled into town and caused a riot. Covered in his Nemean lion cloak, he might have been a beast or a man or some sort of were-lion from a whacked-out episode of True Blood. The commoner screamed and fled. The guard shot arrows that shattered against his cape. Inside the throne room, Eurystheus heard the commotion. His guard scattered in terror. The burly silhouette of a man-lion appeared in the doorway, and the king set a fine example of courage. He dove into a large bronze pot next to the throne. Hercules couldn't hear or see much with his lion hood pulled over his head. He reached the royal dais, pushed back his shaggy cowl, and was surprised to find the throne empty.
Eurystheus?
Hercules called.
Hello? Anyone?
The guards and servants were trembling behind the tapestries. Finally, one of the king's braver heralds, a guy named Coprius, came out waving a white handkerchief.
Hello! Your hairiness! We didn't realize it was you!
Hercules scanned the room.
Where is everyone? Why are the tapestries shaking? Where is the High King?
Coprius dabbed his forehead.
The king is indisposed.
Hercules glanced at the dais.
He's hiding in that decorative pot, isn't he?
No,
Coprius said.
Maybe, yes.
Well, tell His Majesty that I've killed the Nemean lion. I want to know my second task.
Coprius climbed the steps of the dais. He whispered into the bronze pot. The pot whispered back.
The pot says,
Coprius hesitated.
I mean, the High King says you must go to the swamp of Lerna and kill the monster that dwells there. It is a hydra.
A what now?
Hercules thought he might have heard that name in a Captain America movie, but he didn't know how it applied to him.
The hydra is a monster with many poisonous heads,
Coprius explained.
It's been killing our people and our cattle.
Hercules frowned.
I hate monsters that kill cows. I'll be back.
On the way out of town, Hercules realized he had no idea where Lerna was. He stood there, trying to think, when a chariot drawn by a team of black horses pulled up next to him.
Need a ride?
The young man at the reins looked very familiar, but Hercules had been away from Thebes so long he barely recognized his young nephew.
Iolaus?
Hercules laughed with disbelief.
What are you doing here?
Hello, uncle. I heard about your 10 labors and I want to help.
Hercules' heart twisted like a pretzel.
But I tried to kill you. Why would you help me?